Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nick Katman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com, check us out, and get in touch. So today, I am speaking with Rick Beatty. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Yourself?
I'm great. Thank you. Excellent. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So the topic for today is how to get scientific and technical team members to be engaged for company projects, as well as newly assigned tasks not routinely performed by the team. So this is a really good topic. Before we jump into that, could you introduce yourself and your background?
Sure. Be glad to do so. And again, welcome for the opportunity to visit. This is a passionate topic of mine. I've been in the life sciences and scientific community, specifically more into the dietary supplements, API, and OTC fields for over 35 years. I've served all positions from, you know, director of operations, you know, head of R&D and director of quality and so on, many different positions. So I have a very broad knowledge and understanding of the industries in general and how we work. Currently, I'm serving as a senior vice president and chief science officer for the largest contract manufacturer in the United States.
Excellent. So what about this topic kind of made it something that you wanted to discuss?
Well, so again, I'm very passionate. I was very successful in my career, and I had great opportunities for leadership training. Two highlights, I went through the Weltsway management training, but more specifically, I had direct leadership training by a gentleman named Marshall Goldsmith. And in those situations, basically what I learned is you only succeed if your people succeed, and your company will only succeed when your people succeed. So it's your job as a leader, whether that be a supervisor, manager, director, VP, exec, whatever it is, your job is to lead your people and allow them to succeed or succeed in those areas and goals that are established for the firm and the enterprise to move forward. And so it's more importantly to focus on the people and helping them to win and to be able to achieve so that your company can move forward. And that actually can elevate you to much higher levels and move you to new plateaus that maybe you were having obstacles before. So that's really where I focus on trying to focus on the people. And then once they feel you're invested in them, then they will actually be much more committed and be able to work and produce.
Good point. So we hear this type of concept pretty often nowadays. And so I think that my first gut reaction is, why do you think there's still leaders and managers that aren't subscribing to that ideology? What do you think's preventing that?
Well, I believe there's a bit of a generational gap. I mean, look, I'm not a young guy, and I'm clearly in the boomer generation. And honestly, sometimes it's a challenge for someone with my mindset and experience and the life that maybe I grew up in and society I grew up in, to be able to truly comprehend and understand the mindset of the younger generations. And I have most of my employees right now are probably in their late 20s to mid 30s. I mean, I have a few that are older. Most of them are in leadership roles. But the majority of the employees that are working, and again, there's all age ranges, you know, from 25 to 65. But most of them are in the younger generational XYZ millennial groups. And I think there's a bit of a paradigm mind block that occurs between someone with my generational experience and someone with a younger generational experience. And so the leader, it's the leader's onus. It's the leader's responsibility for them to acknowledge that and to make a change. It's not the responsibility of the employee to adjust. Mm-hmm.
And do you remember the moment where you feel like you were shifting from a traditional way of leading and managing to this newer, newly accepted version?
Yeah, I was. So in my younger days, I was quite assertive. I'll use that term gently.
Sure.
And, you know, really was pushing people hard, very aggressive, making a lot of big decisions and, you know, moving forward. Maybe at that time, I was a little bit more focused on my own success and not the success of the enterprise or the people that I worked with. But I had one-on-one training for a week with Marshall Goldsmith. It was a roundtable type discussion, and he and I sat at the same table. And we were in a leadership training forum. And it was really those kind of side discussions I had with Marshall when we would talk, and then he would say things like, what makes you think that, and why does that happen? And I was probably a bit too rigid in my mindset, thinking that, you know, I could just force change and people would have to do what I tell them. It was really that event that was the big switch for me. I had already gone through the Welch Way training. I've had a number of leadership trainings before that as well. But this was a more personal approach that got me thinking about the employees as people and how do you get them to buy into your style? Because I've worked with both ranges. I've worked with CEOs and presidents that were extremely collaborative, very dynamic. And I've worked with CEOs and presidents that were, you know, basically the military general, and you march to his step. And if you don't, you get off the boat or get off the train tracks or whatever. But basically, you know, it was his way or the highway, and he was very rigid. Well, actually, I've had two CEO presidents like that. Needless to say, of course, neither one of them survived very long in the roles they were performing.
What percentage of your generation do you think still has that traditional mindset? And do you think there are younger generations that are adopting the traditional mindset instead of this kind of new way of thinking?
Those are excellent questions. I would say probably half of my generation still has that mindset. What I kind of call it the coal mine mindset. You know, you're in the coal mine, the foreman or the boss says, you know, move this rock, do this, do that, and you just have to do what you're told, right? And I still think that my generation, the boomer generation, of course, we're exiting the employment field, but I think that we still have a lot of obstacles with that, and it's the younger generations. Now, as far as them, I think that only 5 or 10% of the leadership that I've observed in the younger generations have that mindset. But I do think that the younger generation has a big problem that they don't recognize right now, and that is that they're very much into their self-awareness and they're not into the team awareness. So even though my generation, we were struggling with, hey, march to the drum and keep, you know, keep step and don't get out of line and don't wipe your nose or do anything wrong. The younger generation, unfortunately, and a lot of it has to do again with the social communication styles that we use nowadays, but they, I think, are a little bit too focused on their own self-awareness and not as much on to the team awareness. Well, now I'm speaking leadership.
Yeah. I'm not happy that you said that truth, but I think it's important to point that out because it gives validation as to why there are so many books on leadership and management still being produced. Because if it were true that it's a generational thing and that generation is retiring off, then you would just expect the newer generations to be kind of in lockstep with this thinking. But it sounds like there's a different obstacle that's producing the same result. So that's a really insightful point. So at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about kind of scientific and technical teams and being engaged. At the highest level, what do you think are some of the typical issues and challenges that those types of teams face? And what are some of kind of the immediate actions that leaders and management can take in order to identify that it's happening and come up with a plan to address it?
Well, first of all, hopefully the audience will acknowledge that oftentimes the type of personality traits that go into these scientific fields are more introverted and not as extroverted, where, you know, they're not interested in going out to the parties and having a great time, but they're, you know, they're very focused and they can maintain their direction, and, you know, they're able to understand very, very detailed and high complex systems. But there's a corollary to that, and that is that, you know, they're not as able to relate either verbally or expressively to people that maybe aren't quite as, you know, rigid in their mind as others are. And 90% of communication is nonverbal. So, you know, looking at a person's facial expressions, their body posture, their tone of voice, all these other things, a lot of the employees that are technical, they're not able to relate to those things, and they don't have what we now call emotional intelligence. The, you know, the EQ is a fairly recent term in the, you know, society that wasn't really a big thing when I was younger. But basically, I think that the challenge is that these type of individuals, first of all, they can't relate to your reality, and your perception is your reality. I mean, you might say, oh, I might say, you don't understand, you've got it wrong. But the truth is, you're sitting there in your room and you might be hot, and that's your reality. I'm sitting here in my room, I might be cold. That's my reality. But your temperature of your room and the temperature of my room might be exactly identical. So neither one of us is wrong. We're both correct in our experience, in our perception, we're correct. So what we need to do is we first acknowledge the other viewpoints and to acknowledge the other perceptions, not that they're wrong, but they're there. Mm. Once we acknowledge them, then we can begin the discussion on how do we pull those together and come up with a unified understanding of what we should do about it.
Yeah.
So to get back to the point about the scientific and technical team members, they are usually very introverted. Many of them aren't extroverted in their communication, so they don't think their thoughts out loud. They maybe not get their brain in the game because they don't tell you what they think. And of course, for a team to really succeed, everybody needs to pull in together, pulling in the same direction. The worst thing that can happen to a team is you come together, you discuss it, you all say, hey, this is a great idea, let's go out, let's make this happen. And then you go out and you start pulling in one direction, and then other people come in and undermine the effort, right? Because they didn't vocalize what was going on. They didn't get engaged into the commitments and the decisions and the goals. And they had other thoughts that they didn't express. So you're not able to address them. But yet, because they feel frustrated because they think you're doing the wrong thing, or you don't know what you're doing or whatever, they come in and they undermine your efforts. And that's that submarining of those efforts is actually what often destroys a lot of opportunities and a lot of success, because nobody's working together at that point.
I want to take a short tangent. So a couple things you talked about, EQ and perception is reality. Perception is reality is something that I say almost daily. It's a big part of how I think. Interestingly enough, the way you describe it is true, and the way I think about it is also true, but they're different. So when I think about perception is reality, I would say I have a pen, and if I ask 100 people what this is, and 100 people say it's a cell phone, is it a cell phone or is it a pen? Well, I would argue that it's a cell phone, because 100 people, and that's actually a probably not the best example. I usually use color. So I'd say, all right, this is gray. But if I ask 100 people and they say it's blue, is it blue or is it gray? Well, if perception is reality and 100 people believe it's blue, then it's actually blue. And the reason
colorblind and you don't know it.
You could be colorblind and not know it. Right. So I guess the reason I say perception is reality is twofold. One is a lot of times we have very strong, rigid belief systems. And if you're constantly hearing something different from the majority, then doesn't mean that it's necessarily correct, but you definitely have to pause and reevaluate your beliefs. The other thing too, I think about it from a kind of a customer standpoint, is if I know I'm doing an excellent job and the client doesn't believe that, part of my job is to explain to the client why the service I'm delivering is good. Similarly, if I believe I'm delivering a bad service, but the client thinks I'm the best thing since sliced bread, then I'm the best thing since sliced bread. So it just kind of helps create a pause when you have your own belief system on something to reevaluate when it's necessary. Now, when it comes to EQ, I've been in a lot of different sessions that talk about EQ. And as I understand it, the purpose of EQ is to understand how different individuals that you interact with perceive the communication. How are you supposed to be communicating with them, right? Now, the challenge is oftentimes you're going against your natural way of communicating. Also, we deal with so many different people. Sometimes it can seem to be a challenge to remember how everybody likes to be communicated with. So can you give me your kind of two cents on how you view EQ and how has it worked for you and what do you struggle with?
Well, that's excellent. I've had the opportunity in my career to work in almost 50 nations worldwide. And that's introduced me to a lot of different cultures, different societies. And everybody's culture is not identical. Honestly, an American culture is a lot different, say, than a European culture or even an Asian culture. And so I think the first thing that's important to understand is that, it's not you as the leader that they have to adjust to, right? You have to adjust to them. If you can't communicate to them and have them receive it and understand it, then the communication failed, right? So the communication's responsibility is not on the hearer, right? It's on the speaker. It's on the person who's projecting, and it's up to you to come up. And so the only way that I know to do that is what I call reflective listening, which is, of course, is like, maybe have a discussion, then ask, okay, what are we talking about? What is it that you understand that I've said? And then that allows you to gauge how much of it they really understood. If not well, then you need to change your approach. You need to change how you're speaking or transitioning or communicating. Some people are kinesthetic, some people are visual, some people are auditory. And so depending upon that style of person, you might change some of your phraseology. So a simple example would be, if I'm communicating to you and you were auditory, right? I would be using one thing. If you were using visual, I might say, well, how do you see this happening, right? That's then getting you back into the way you think. Now, as a leader, when you're talking to a broad team, you don't know that, and not everybody's in there as one style, so you're better off using them all, right? That's the way that you communicate best. I kind of make a joke about it when I'm doing leadership training, but, when a person falls in love and you're trying to convince the other person that you're in love with, that you love them and hopefully they love you back, you use every form of communication that you can think of to try and communicate that over, right? And then one of those forms hopefully connects with the person that's the recipient so that they respond back and reflect back the same thing to you. So,
yeah,
but that's the point. You have to use different styles.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. One of the books just talking about love is The Five Love Languages. I don't know if you've ever read that. But there's essentially five different types of way or methods that people accept and perceive love. So mine is words of affirmation. So I really appreciate it when my wife kind of gives me pats on the back and, you know, pumps up my tires. I really like that. She is a physical touch and acts of service. So the way she perceives love is when I do the dishes and when I give her a hug and things like that. So it's interesting how, you know, that right there, there's a good example of different right. ways of communicating. We did take a little bit of a tangent and we were talking about how some team members could undermine other team members' efforts. Could we go back to that point and could you expand on that? And you mentioned that you had done a lot of leadership training. So I kind of want to see where you're going with that.
So for any team to succeed, the first and foremost that any team has to have, the three absolute fundamental bedrock foundation is they have to have respect, trust, and communication. If those three things don't exist, then I don't care if you're talking about a sports team, chess team, you know, scientific team. I don't care what kind of team. If those things don't exist, the team will never succeed, right? So when you have these kind of behaviors, it's a behavior where people are undermining the effort of the team. That reflects a deeper challenge. That reflects something that's going on within that individual. Either that something's happened in how they respect you or someone else on the team, or maybe they don't trust what you've said to them. Maybe they've been hurt in the past or made promises. Promises were made to them that were not fulfilled, all those kind of things. So you have to, again, I get back to my one-on-one type approach. You have to be able to approach those people and talk to them and find out why they're behaving the way they are and what the obstacles are. Not that they're, you know, you're not trying to turn them into a mean person. You're not trying to blame them. You're not trying to do anything that way. You're just trying to help understand. And hopefully if you do it the right way, you build them up. You let them know that you're there to help them grow. You help them to mentor them, to help them understand. And we all have obstacles. All of us do. You do, I do, we all do. And we hopefully will receive, you know, the critique in a kind way. It's hopefully given in a kind way. Then we establish goals and how we can try to, personal goals, on how we can try to help that person not only overcome those issues, but then turn around and help the team grow. Because there has to be an acknowledgement at some point that by that person and yourself, that this kind of behavior will stymie the efforts of the team or the company or the department that you're working in. Now, let me say, you know, this may be a bit harsh, but this comes out of the Welch Way training approach. You know, there some employees you can't redeem. You know, there's the 10 or 20% that they're too far gone, they won't change, they're old, who knows what. There's a thousand and one different ways it might cause that, right? And, you know, that means that person will never help the team or the company improve, and they're just stuck. So then the next thing you have to do is you have to say, well, look, should we put them on a different seat on the bus? Right. You guys, you probably read Good to Great and many of those other books.
IPRS, yeah.
And so, you know, you then have to, rather than saying, well, you know, let's get rid of them, I don't want them on my team. Well, maybe they're in the wrong seat on the bus. I used to have a guy that I worked with. He was honest. I can honestly say he was the most critical person I've ever probably met. He was always criticizing everything, everybody, everything that he saw. His lens of life was the glasses half empty all the time. And it didn't matter who or what he was talking about.
I think we all have one of those.
I know. you know, it would have been easy to say, I don't want him on my team, get him out of the company or whatever. But no, he just needed to, you need to find a position where that skill set, and that's what it is, by the way, it's a skill, that skill set becomes an asset. And so we moved him to a different role, a different position that allowed that ability to be able to see those weaknesses and see those things and obstacles and all the challenges as an opportunity then to help us move forward. So hopefully that'd be the first thing you do. Ultimately, though, of course, if you can't do all those things, you've worked in a way, then you have to find somebody that's better. But let me say on that topic, you know, 50% of the time, before you let anybody go, you should look yourself in the mirror and say, well, I failed, because ultimately your goal is to drive everybody to improve. But 50% of the time, the person you hire is not no better than the person you let go. So you always have to be cautious when you do things like that.
Mm-hmm. So that was all really good information. I really like your respect, trust, and communication. Interestingly enough, I have 2/3 of that in my household. So my wife and I have family rules, and we only have 2. Respect and no lying. So you need to respect the people in the house and you need not to lie. Now for any parents that are listening, here's the secret. I can take anything as disrespect. So when my son doesn't make his bed, I say, Vinny, when I ask you to do your bed and you don't do your bed, I take that as a sign of disrespect. And once you start throwing that word out, everybody gets really rattled. So, and I always say, we only have 2 rules. Is that too many? And they say, no, Dad, that's not too many. But I like the communication. So I'm wondering if I might be able to kind of enter that into our family values. So that's really good. I agree with that. You also were talking about, you know, there's like, you know, 10 or 20% of people that are, for lack of a better term, unredeemable. And right. So that kind of goes into my mind of the bell curve. So there's going to be 10 to 20% that you don't have to essentially do anything from a leadership and management standpoint. They're just going to be excellent players no matter what you do, because that's just who they are. On the other side of the bell curve, you can do everything you can to try to get them in a good place where they can execute and be a contributing member of the team, and they just won't be able to, right? Now with that, there's, you know, 60 to 80% that are malleable. And I think that is something that everybody in the audience needs to understand, is that for the vast majority of the people that you're leading and managing, they're responding to your cues. And right. They are going to elevate, or they're going to not perform as well as they should be, depending on how you're doing what you need to do. I do subscribe to the, you know, getting the right people on the bus and putting them in the right seat. There's been several instances within our organization where somebody was the right person for the company, but wasn't in the right seat. And it's a pretty invigorating feeling when you can take somebody that wasn't succeeding and move them to a different place, and now they excel. So that's a real possibility. And I think we should put an exclamation point next to that, because until I read Grit to Great or I implemented EOS, if somebody was failing in their role, I don't think I took a second chance to say, well, maybe they belong somewhere else within the company. I just said, you know, they're not producing or they're not succeeding, and therefore they need to exit the organization. So, and you end up shooting yourself in the foot if you don't, you know, pause and see if there is a better place for them. And I think, again, it's very invigorating when you move somebody into a different role and they excel. Everybody's really, really excited about that.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that. So I do think that as a leader, you need to also trust your instincts too, because I had a situation where we had an opening in the laboratory. We were trying to promote from within, and it was a position that would be running the HPLCs, and nobody applied. And so we were looking at, you know, going to start doing interviews and bring someone in. Well, we had a gentleman working in a completely different department, nothing to do scientifically. In fact, his degree, he got a degree, bachelor's degree in sculpturing with, and I found out later it was paper sculptures that he made.
Oh.
And I went up to him. I said, "Dave, why didn't you apply for this position?" And he goes, "Rick, well, I'm not even qualified." I said, "Well, you can do the job. I'm convinced of it. Why don't you apply and get interviewed?" And so on. So he did. And they brought him in. And because he looked at the clock completely different than all the other scientists, right? He was looking at it completely different from his mindset. He was a fantastic team member. He helped solve a lot of problems and resolved issues that have been going on for a long time. He was able to troubleshoot equipment and all sorts of things. So you do have to be a little bit instinctive, I think. And again, I'm trying to find people and give them opportunities, I think, is a great thing.
Yeah. There was a book I read by Jocko Willink, who was a former, I believe he was a Navy SEAL. In any event, the book he wrote was Extreme Ownership. And essentially the point is everything is your fault, good and bad. And the reason I bring that up is, you know, when you bring somebody into the organization and they don't succeed, it is your fault as a leader and a manager, because either A, you hired them that way, or you fired them that way, meaning you should have never hired them in the first place. Or if you should have hired them, you didn't train them adequately, and therefore you had to fire them. So, right. We're all humans. We're all not perfect, and we are gonna, you know, make some hiring mistakes. But I think that the success rate within a leader and manager should be perceived as something that should be pretty high.
Often I would say I deal with that. You know, I try to walk the floor, talk to everybody in my department. And, you know, not every day, of course, but I wish I could say I talk with everyone once a week, but that's not true either. But I make my efforts. And you know, and of course, and on a monthly basis, I definitely will have gone to every facility and walked and talked with everybody there. But when I meet the people that are within my group or on my team, and a lot of others that are actually that maybe my team supports or services their work, you know, I say, "Hey, what can I do for you? How can I help you?" And, you know, and then as you get to know the people, you know, "Hey, how's school going? You know, how was this? How was that?" I think they love it when you show that you're interested in them personally and that you remember them. And you'd be surprised, those little things, what a big difference can make in the attitude. I was doing a training at a company that I'd started with. And after I started the team, I said, "Well, you know, what kind of a team do you think we're on?" And every one of them said, "I'm not on a team." Anyways, we got talking. Of course, I was new there. But as I got talking, I found out they all felt like they just lived in a hole in the ground, and people threw problems in on top of them. They had to fix the problems. So as we started working together and developing the teamwork concept and taking personal interest, it was amazing to see their attitude change, smiling, happy, coming in. And, you know, many of them come in and say, "Oh, I just love working for you," you know. And obviously, it's not any grandiose change that occurred, really. It's their perception that changed. Their perception changed about how the company was treating them, how they were valued, and how they were recognized. And that gets to the second part of, you know, we talk about respect, trust, and communication. Those are the other three sides of the equation, but those don't come from the team. They come from you as the leader. They come from the leadership side, where you talking about the recognition and that you value them and how do you treat them. And that's how they gauge you. And then that reciprocates back to them so that they then perform accordingly, right? So the more you can show recognition, and I'm not saying, you know, some amazing, "Oh, you want a flight to, you know, the Bahamas or whatever." I'm just talking small things. And that little bit is makes a big difference. And you can read many, it's been studied for decades, right? That the pay is not the number one motivator, right? Payment obviously is a motivator, but that's not the number one motivator. So in order for you to get more done, to do more, to excel, to get to that higher level, you need to be able to create those things that motivate the people to want to do more, to want to be better, to want to achieve. And then ultimately, if you can create that kind of culture within your department and your team will succeed, your department succeed, that means you're succeeding. And then in the area that I work in, which is all of the regulatory science quality side, if we win, everybody wins, because that means our products are better, and we're able to achieve more. And of course, the Deming philosophy is all else being equal, quality will always win. And so by getting better products in the marketplace at the same or lower cost, then the company wins. So it's just a win-win approach that is able to help. And ultimately, here's the bottom line. This is what I tell my employees. I said, look, you don't come to work because you love me. Right? You come to work and you work hard because of other things that you care for and other things that you love. When you leave here, those are the reasons why you come to work. So if I can help them succeed and achieve, they really understand that it's that that's giving them the opportunity to reward those things outside of work. Right. So that's the culture you want to generate within the group, within the team, and ultimately within the company.
Great. Excellent. I do want to challenge you on one point.
That's so, right.
So you said go and ask your the people that report to you, know, how can I help you? Now, I agree with that. And what I've found is there are employees that don't want to give the perception that they can't handle the workload. And so they're hesitant to ask for help even when they know, or maybe the help that they need is not really appropriate for you, or you know, they're very impacted by our level of satisfaction, and so they don't want us to be disappointed, right? Mm-hmm. So can you comment on that?
Well, there's really two or three things. First of all, from a resource side, right, the job of a supervisor or manager, you get things done through others. That's the only way you get things done. So the job, your job is to provide others, those people that work for you, all the tools and resources they need to perform and complete their job. So if you don't have that, if you can't provide that, it's still your job to get it, right? You can't say, oh, I can't do that for you. Oh, I don't know that, right? Just like some companies I've worked with that are in the entertainment business, they basically say, look, you own every complaint. If you're, it doesn't matter whether you're a hand stage, a custodian, you know, anybody. If someone from the audience comes up and said, "Hey, my seat's dirty," or whatever, right? You can't just walk away and say, "Oh, that's not my job. I don't do that," right? It's your job to help take care of it. Well, from a leadership position, that is your job. You have to help resolve that. Now, maybe you don't have the skills, the knowledge, the aptitude. Maybe, again, it's not within your department. Maybe it's over in human resources or whatever. But it's your job to get the correct tool and resources for the employee. So that's the first point I'd like to make. The second one, though, is more related to the employee and the style. Obviously, there are employees out there that want to, you know, butter the boss up and, you know, make them look happy and be the teacher's pet or whatever. You have to be careful of that. But ultimately, your responsibility is to help that employee perform. So if they're not willing to open up, right, if they're not willing to express, and I have some employees, one employee in particular right now, who's in my document position, they're extremely meek. That's a better, best word I can use, right? Great employee, work hard worker, right? Very capable, but very, very meek. And they're not able to really come out of themselves a little bit. And again, it might be due to cultural things, personality traits, the way they were brought up, I don't know. But basically, you still have to come up with different ways to get them to come out of themselves a little bit. And this is where those, you talked about the five love languages, right? But this is where you have to use different approaches to try and do that. You know, that employee just walking up and say, hey, how you doing? How can I help you today? You'll never get any response from that employee ever, right? It just won't happen. Now, I'll use an example of a thing that occurred in my family. I have a lot of children, and my middle son, I realized when he was 8 years old, finally triggered with me. He would come up to talk to me and he'd say, hey, Dad, but guess what? I found out he always had to touch me. He either had to have a hand on my shoulder or a hand on my hip, you know, or sit right next to me, because I realized that he was very kinesthetic. Mm. And in his way he was created, right, is that his mind worked by these kinesthetics. And once I finally understood that, and again, I didn't really register with that till he was about 8, suddenly I knew how to communicate to him and how to work with him and how to help him and how to help him grow. And ultimately, he was extremely good with his hands and anything to do with his hands, he was amazing with. Now he's married and doing great. But the point is that you have a responsibility to come up with, how does that person relate to their job? How do they relate with you? And how do you get them to communicate to you? Yeah. So that just takes a little bit of effort. It just doesn't happen just because you ask for it.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because we as leaders and managers spend a lot of time trying to improve ourselves in the work environment. And that's half of our life. Half of our life is our family and our loved ones. And every so often, there will be a trainer that will explain how their philosophy and approach can make a positive impact on the work environment. And then they remind you that you should also utilize that tactic and strategy within your own family. And so one of the things I think would be good just to kind of remind the audience is, as much as we're trying to improve ourselves as leaders and managers within our work environment, take a second to think about how that applies. Oh, I almost knocked my microphone over. How that applies to your own family environment. So I just wanted to highlight that. Within the topic that we're talking about, I know people love stories. Within this topic, in terms of, you know, kind of the more technical people and how to best lead and manage them, can you share a story about one event that you're A, most proud of, and B, you think can underscore a lesson that the audience can take away?
Well, I can give it a shot. There's just a lot in my career that I could talk about, but I would say the things that I value are related to the employees that I've helped. And I can think of multiple efforts, times, but you know, I've hired a lot of people right out of college. You know, they have no work history. They just got a degree. We went to a job fair, talked with them, and, you know, then you bring them in. Of course, you train them. They didn't know what to do, but you're training them and growing them. And to see those kind of employees that, you know, they trust you, and so they work with you. But over time, you see them gain more and more skill sets and more and more skill sets. And, you know, I've got multiple employees that no longer work for me, right? And this is in that distribution you talked about. You know, this is on the plus one or two sigma out there, right? So these employees, one of them is the global director for development, the very large company that's on the S&P 500. There's another one that's, you know, the head of the quality, and another one that's, you know, the head of the development side in an oil business. So it's very good to see these people. One guy that I know is now the president and CEO of an industrial waste business. So it's very great to see these people kind of take these tools that you help them develop, and then they grow, and then they take those and go somewhere else and help grow them again. So, you know, in the Welch Way leadership training, you've got the shooting star type of employees. And if you don't find them opportunities, if you don't recognize and show them, then they'll go find someone that will, right? So that's one thing you need to always understand. So don't take it personal if somebody decides to come in and say, hey, I'm going to go elsewhere. You know, usually I just pat them on the back and I say, hey, good luck to you. It's been nice to work with you. It's been a great opportunity and I wish you the best. You can't take that personal. And then the other side of it is you need to be able to realize that there's people that will never change, right? You can give them all the same tools, all the same ability, everything, and then they won't take up the baton. They won't carry it forward. They won't move it forward. And unfortunately, I wish I could say, you know, life was different, but that's the way some people are. Mm-hmm. And so you just at some point have to decide, you know, how much more work am I going to give to this employee to try and help them? The best thing that I have is what I've done in my career with that is I would do time valuation studies. I would sit them down. I would say, look, here's the problem. Here's the obstacles. Here's the changes you need to implement. I want you to do it. I want you to grow. I want to keep you. And let's develop an improvement plan to do it. And if they will, you know, a light will go off and they'll suddenly buy into it and suddenly they'll be the best employee. They might be the best employee you've ever had because they'll come back years later and say, wow, I realized what a poor employee was. I'm fortunate you didn't fire me. I'm glad you kept me, right? Mm. Hopefully that's the outcome, but not always.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, I want to ask you two final questions. You referenced some of the training that you've gone through. So for the audience, I'm just curious to know, you know, what are your favorite trainings on leadership and management, or maybe your favorite books that people can go and view for themselves? And then my second question is, you've given a lot of advice on ways that we can improve our leadership and management, but if there was, you know, one, two, or three pieces that you just wanted to make sure that people were reminded of before they, you know, end this recording, what would those be?
Well, thank you. So I mentioned Marshall Goldsmith at the beginning, and without a doubt, in my opinion, he's the forefront of these kind of concepts. It doesn't matter what kind of widgets that you make or service you provide, he can help you out. He has a free YouTube video channel called Thinkers 50. Marshall's getting a little older now. He used to do all the videos himself. Now he has a lot of great people that also do that. They usually put out little short videos. When I say short, you know, 5, 10, 20 minutes max. And they'll do that a few times a week. I would highly recommend anybody who wants to develop into stronger business, stronger leadership, how to work with people. And again, it doesn't matter what kind of business you're in. And Marshall can help that mindset. So I would strongly recommend that. Of course, there's a lot of great books out there and everything. We're all short on time. And so this would be something that you could do, even if you like riding the subway and just, you know, listen to your phone for a few minutes. It can help motivate you. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is with regards to employees, if I have one flaw, it's probably that I end up taking too much of a personal interest, where I really do care for people. And I suppose that's part of my personality. So whenever people are failing or they're not performing, especially after I've developed a rapport for them, it really is hard, you know, hard on my heart to see that. And I do care for them. But ultimately, you need to come up with what works for you so that you can get the best out of your team in the environment you're given. And I mentioned now six things, right? So you've got the beginning, respect, trust, and communication, but you also have to have the responsibility, the recognition side of it. And I, one word I didn't talk about, but I think we need to include it in there, and that is training. You know, employee, if you go to employee and say, hey, fix my car, I need a new transmission, I'll give you all the tools you need to do it. But if you don't give them the training, then you failed, right? On the corollary of that, you hire a person, an expert mechanic, and he already knows how to do that, and say, hey, here's my car, put a new transmission in it, but you don't give him the tools, right? It doesn't matter what his knowledge set is and how expert, you know, he may be. He might be the best mechanic the world's ever seen, but if he has no tools to do the work either, right, it's the same problem. So your job, in addition to those things, is finally the training. Now, what kind of training do you give the employees? Unfortunately, a lot of companies hire someone, they throw them in there. It's basically the school of hard knocks. You either have to perform or we're going to fire you and get out of here. Well, that's just most of the time setting people up for failure. You will never get 100% of their performance because they feel underappreciated, underrecognized, and they know they're underperforming because they weren't given the training. So that is your fault, not the employee's fault. And unfortunately, a lot of companies, especially when they promote from within, they go, oh, here's Joe Blow. He's doing a great job. Let's him, you know, running this machinery. Let's make him a supervisor with all the other people, and he'll get them to run the machinery as good as he did. Look, the skill set of running the machinery is completely different than the skill set of managing and supervising and training the people to run the machinery, right? So just don't assume that he has those skill sets just because he can do it great himself. So that would be the final corollary there, is that you need to make sure you do the training.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I really appreciate your insight, Rick. I'm positive that people got at least one, two, or three nuggets out of this. So I really appreciate it. And as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to get in touch about project or resource needs, head over to thefdagroup.com to get in touch with us, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. So thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see y'all next time. And Rick, thanks again.
Good luck, everybody.